All right. My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana. We're starting, we're in the second day of a series on how the Bible handles hatred. Yesterday we looked at Mark's gospel and saw how Mark tries to help people cope with hatred of the world toward the community. Matthew is also working on the problem of hatred, only it's a different kind of hatred. As we'll see, it's an internal within the community kind of hatred that he's working on. So I tried to think of some humor about internal differences and difficulties so as to honor Elmer Witt's suggestion that humor is critical to Holden Village and its whole ethos. And so the best I could come up with was this. I once heard a Roman Catholic scholar, biblical scholar, Gerard Sloyan, explain how Catholics can tell the difference between all these various kinds of Protestants that there are in the world. And he said, what you do is you watch the response of each different person after he or she has fallen down a flight of stairs. And the way they respond to such an experience will help you tell which kind they are. A Presbyterian, after falling down the flight of stairs at the bottom, will say, well, thank God that's over. A Methodist will pick himself or herself up and say, I really must do that better next time. And a Lutheran will sit there for a moment and then say, I really am sorry. So hopefully by the end of today's session we may see how that little story is appropriate to today's subject. Matthew is a very different gospel in some ways from Mark, even though 90% of Mark's gospel appears in Matthew. And most scholars assume that that's because Matthew was using Mark as a source for putting together his own story of Jesus. There are still a few who think it goes the other way, that Mark was summarizing Matthew rather than Matthew expanding upon Mark, but I'm among those who believe it to be Matthew expanding upon Mark. Matthew is a Jewish author, unlike Mark, who Marcus is not a very good Jewish name. That's a Gentile fellow. Matthew is a Jewish person, and you can tell that from a number of things. Not only the subject matter, which is very steeped in Old Testament texts that Gentiles wouldn't have even understood the importance of, but all sorts of little things as well, such as the fact that though Matthew writes in Greek, the word order that he uses in many cases is Aramaic. It's sort of the way I talk German. I know the vocabulary, but for the life of me, I cannot get all the verbs at the end. So I talk in German words when I talk German, but in English sentence structures. Well, Matthew talks or writes in Aramaic sentence structures using Greek words. So it's clear you have someone whose mother tongue is Aramaic who's trying to write in Greek. So lots of little clues that this is a Jewish person who's trying to, a Jewish convert to Christianity, who's trying to make himself clear more than anything else to fellow Jewish people. At least that's a major part of his audience. Matthew's book is organized around five blocks of teaching material. And Jesus in Matthew is always having the important experiences on mountains. I don't know if that reminds you of anybody else who's always up on a mountain and has five collections of material. You know, obviously, Jesus and Moses are being compared in much of Matthew's gospel. Another clue as to the Jewishness of the whole perspective of this gospel. Matthew's constantly quoting the Old Testament, and there are 11 very important places where he actually cites a piece of Old Testament text with a formula that says, this took place to fulfill what appears in this or that Old Testament place. As for the method for understanding Matthew and what Matthew's agenda is compared to Mark, we're going to look at things that are unique to Matthew. Where Matthew departs from Mark and does something very different, it gives us a clue as to what Matthew's problems in his own community were that he sought to address, things that are different from what Mark had to deal with. We're going to start, like we did yesterday, at the beginning of the Gospel. In Mark's Gospel, we saw Jesus comes out of nowhere, virtually. We don't know anything except that as an adult, he shows up from Galilee to get baptized by John, and his life begins with baptism. Matthew, if you would turn to Matthew 1, please. Matthew begins with what's known as a genealogy, which seems like a dull way to begin a story. I don't know about you, but whenever Sunday school teachers told me to try to read the whole Bible straight through, it was always one of those chapters of begats, somewhere along the line that stalled me, and I would put it off till next year. But that's how Matthew begins. The first line of the genealogy tells you much about what Matthew wants that genealogy to communicate to us. It's a genealogy of someone who is Messiah, son of David, and son of Abram. And for the Jews that Matthew wants to convince that Jesus was indeed the Messiah of Israel, it is very important that he is an heir of David and a true son of Abram. And there's a ton of other stuff about this genealogy that's exceedingly interesting, including its overall structure into three parts of 13 generations each, and the crucial points at each 13th generation, and so forth. But what we're interested here this morning in tracking down what to do with hatreds causes us to have to limit the what we're interested here to a couple of other things. Notice what characters are listed here in this genealogy. Abraham is the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah. So this is a patriarchy, a genealogy of fathers, which is a little surprising in some ways, since Matthew's going to go out of his way to point out that Joseph, the last one listed here, was not the father of Jesus. But legally, in that society, regardless of who your mother was, your legal status as an heir or not an heir, a slave or whatever, was on the basis of what your father decided, and so your father was listed in your genealogy. But Matthew sticks a few of the mothers in here, which are not necessary, and thus, because they don't really need to be here, they're a clue to something that Matthew's going to do throughout his book. Notice verse 3. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Anybody remember that story? Very interesting story, which I'll let you read at your leisure sometime. I'll summarize it briefly. Genesis 38 is the story of the birth of those two twins. Judah had a couple of sons. Tamar married the oldest one named Ur, and it simply says in Genesis 38, God did not like him, so he slew him. So poor Tamar's out of a husband. By law, the brother, Onan, was supposed to take her and help her bear a child so that she would have a son, and that would be the heir then to Judah's family property. But Onan knows that if he goes ahead and does that, he won't get the birthright. It will belong to the older brother's offspring, which he will have helped come into being by means of Tamar. So he, the Bible says, spills his seed on the ground so as to not let his brother have offspring. And so the Lord slays him for doing that. So Tamar now has no one except a little bitty brother who Judah says, if you want to, you can wait for, and then I'll give him to you for husband. Tamar says, okay. She hangs around years later. He gives the boy to someone else, forgets all about Tamar. So what's Tamar to do? To have someone to take care of her in her old age. She goes out and plays the prostitute.
Oh yeah, and Judah.
That's right. Out in the place where Judah is shearing his sheep, Judah comes and says to her, you know, what is the price? You know, I'll give you a kid from my flocks if you let me lie with you. But I don't have it with me. Do you take MasterCard? Tamar says, well, give me your signet ring and your staff, and you can lie with me. He says, okay. Gives her the signet ring and the staff, lies with her, leaves. She goes home. He tells his servant, here's a kid from the flock, go pay the prostitute. So the servant goes to town, he can't find her. So he's in a curious position. He's trying to pay off a prostitute that he can't find. So he's going around town saying, have you seen the prostitute? I gotta pay her. And they say, there's no prostitute here. So he finally gets tired of making a fool of himself, goes back and tells Judah, I'm sorry, I can't find her. Okay. 3 months later, Tamar's pregnant. It's told to Judah, your daughter-in-law is pregnant without benefit of husband. Oh my gosh, Judah is outraged. Hauls her to the city gates, is going to have her stoned to death for this terrible sin. And just when they're about to do away with her, Tamar says, do you want to know who the father of my child is? I have this here signet ring. Do you know whose it is?
Judah.
And Judah says, oh my goodness, you are more righteous than I. And he takes her then as one of his wives, and the twins become his heirs. And that's Perez and Zerah. Now, Tamar could be called a hero, a resourceful person who did what she had to do in order to overcome the injustices that have been done her by these men. On the other hand, Judah's behavior is not exactly exemplary in a variety of ways. Moving on down the line a few generations, we get to verse 5, Salmon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab. Remember Rahab?
Mm-hmm.
Another
Jericho, had their red corner hanging.
That's right. That's right. Lot's daughters is the mother of Moab. Yeah, Lot's daughters, remember, were left alone with Lot after their mother was destroyed after the Sodom incident, and they realized they were never going to have children up there. They were never going to find husbands up there in the cave with their father, so they conspired to get their father drunk on successive nights, and they both lay with him and both got pregnant by him. He didn't even remember getting up or lying down. And that's where the Moabites came from.
And what was the other daughter, is the mother of
Ammonites? Ammonites. Yeah. Ammonites and the Moabites, that's where they came from. Probably that's not how the Moabites traced their own ancestry. But this is how the Israelites explain where the Moabites came from. You know where the Moabites come from? Drunken incest. So, not doing too well here. Well, that too.
They have to do what they have to do.
That's true.
They got drunk.
Yeah, the women in the story are all these women are heroes. I don't know about the next one for sure. David was the father of Solomon, not by Bathsheba, but by the wife of Uriah. So Uriah, the murdered man, gets mentioned. And his wife, whom David took, is the mother of the next person in the genealogy. So Matthew doesn't have to mention all these women. You don't need women in a genealogy. But every one of these stories is a story of, at least to some extent, a sleaze factor. In the family. Yeah. And that's a big risk for Matthew to be taking. It's a clue as to how important it is that a people comes to terms with the sleazy things that go on in it, because if you're wanting to prove that someone is the Messiah, you'd probably want to portray his background as purely as you could, I would think. But Matthew takes the risk of making sure that we remember that particular batch of stories by mentioning these women. So Matthew's interested in that kind of thing that happens in families and communities and in the history of peoples.
Maybe he's also, it just seems to me that Jesus often, so often went out and sought out the outsider or the people that weren't thought of very highly. And so
that's one of the reasons why I think why this is here. Jesus' genealogy shows that those people who might have got, you know, dumped from the family belong. They have a part in this. The outsiders.
Yeah, that the outsiders are worthy and have something to offer.
Yes,
exactly. To the family.
Because one of Matthew's agendas is trying to legitimate the Gentile mission of the predominantly Jewish Christian movement at this point.
And also they thought of women as just property.
Well, that's true too.
Whatsoever.
Right.
But Jesus really raised them up to a higher level.
There's also a parallel between these women to a degree and Mary, in as much as these women who are in some state of ignominy rise to the challenge and become heroines.
Right, yeah.
And so too Mary, who finds herself in a very compromising situation.
Yes.
Is in fact proved to be the virtuous woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we get to the birth story, there's a ton of stuff we could say about that too. We could spend a whole period just on birth narratives. But I want to just point out one feature that will be important for what we're going to do later. In verse 21, when the angel is telling Joseph, "She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus," the significance of that name is stated as this: "For he will save his people from their sins." So let's remember that. The name Jesus is going to be connected to saving people from sins. So, lots of other stuff we could look at here. It's fascinating to read this story and see that you have another Joseph here who has dreams. And because of the dreams of this Joseph fellow, they end up down in Egypt. Because there's another nasty king who's killing Hebrew babies. Only this time, the nasty king who's killing Hebrew babies isn't in Egypt, it's in the Promised Land. And so this time we're fleeing the Promised Land to get away. So Exodus is rattling around in the background here, and we could have a lot of fun unpacking what all that means. But we have to move on. We're going to start tracking things that have to do with forgiving sins. We'll go to the Sermon on the Mount. If you would please look at Matthew 5 for a moment. In the spot where Jesus talks about hatred, you have verse 21, Matthew 5:21. "You've heard it said to the old timers, 'You shall not murder. Whoever murders shall be liable to judgment.' I say that if you're angry, you'll be liable to judgment. You call somebody names, you're liable to hellfire." And then verse 23, "When you're offering your gift at the altar and you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother or sister, then come and give me gifts." So I don't want your gifts. We can't talk unless you got stuff straight out there in your relationships. We can't just let anger and hatred and name-calling just sit out there. You do something about it. Chapter 6, when they teach, when Jesus teaches prayer in Matthew, only Luke and Matthew have the actual teaching of the Our Father. But in Matthew, when Jesus teaches the Our Father, he concludes in verse 14 of chapter 6 with the note that if you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others, neither will your Father forgive you your trespasses. So you can't just act like God will just clean up anything if you're not willing to be a forgiver yourself. Similar theme to what we saw back there in chapter 5.
In this, in chapter 5, at verse 23, it talks about, if you remember that your brother has something against you, but it doesn't talk about the other way around, really, does it? If you have something against your brother. I mean, I'm just curious. It seems like you may not know the other way, but you'd know if you had a lot of stuff against other people.
Right, right. Yeah, I never noticed that. The next text we're going to go to turns it around the other way. Maybe that'll help us figure out what the relationship is between those two. But the next text I was going to go to is Matthew 18, which is some uniquely Matthean material, which is all about what you do with sin in a community, stuff that threatens to break the community apart. It begins with some paragraphs about some folks that Matthew refers to, or Jesus in Matthew refers to, as little ones. And there's some discussion about exactly who he's talking about. New members of the community, weaker members of the community. It's not exactly clear. But in any case, people are warned not to do anything that would make these people fall away, stumble, be lost to us. And don't despise those little ones either, those ones that we're always in danger of losing. Verse 10, for I tell you that in heaven their angels continually are in the presence of the Father. What do you think? If a shepherd has 100 sheep and one goes astray, doesn't he leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the other one? So God is portrayed here as one who cannot rest if even one of the sheep is lost. If the community loses one person, it's a problem that we cannot ignore. Okay, with that context then, we move to the critical verses in 15 and following. This is a piece with a long history in Christianity. When I grew up in a Christian community in Nebraska, I remember the adults talking from time to time about how something had happened that meant we had to do Matthew 18 on someone. And this is what they meant they were going to do. They were going to invoke Matthew 18, 15 and following. Let's look at this. This is what you do if something happens in the community that threatens to fracture it. If another member of the church sins against you, or as a lot of the translations say, if a brother sins against you, go and point out the fault when the two of you are alone. If the member listens to you, you've regained that one. If not, take along a couple of others. And if that doesn't work, take it to the whole congregation. And if that doesn't work, let such a one be to you a Gentile and a tax collector.
Are there very many places that still practice this? Many congregations?
I don't know that it's the tradition to invoke it so literally anymore.
I have heard of it being done in congregations.
Yeah.
It's actually in the congregation I was in before as part of the constitution of the congregation. I don't know that it was ever used, but it was constitution.
I think people in the Anabaptist tradition, including the Mennonites, have really developed a lot of practices around this, with shunning being the final stage.
Right. Yeah. But now let's just hunker down on this here for a moment. Does anybody's Bible have a different translation than this business about if someone sins against you, go, the NRSV says, point out the fault. The older RSV says, tell him his fault. Anybody got a different one?
King James says, trespass against thee. Go and tell him his fault.
Okay. How do you suppose, imagine, what is the content of that speech? Something's happened. You feel sinned against. You go to the other person, and the directive is tell him his fault, tell her her fault. What are you going to say? Or, at least in the NRSV, it's go and point out the fault. In the RSV, it's tell him his fault.
Well, the whole point of it is restoration. To restore the lost one.
Yeah, that's very clear, because the very next line is, if it works, you've restored kinship, sibling relationship. And coming hard on the heels of the parable of the lost sheep, obviously the point is finding a lost one and restoring the community.
This is really very similar to any kind of conflict resolution. You're in a work group and you're having a problem with a particular person. That's really the process that is most successful to use.
Yeah, conflict resolution mode, yeah. I don't know, I've never been through one of those kinds of workshops, but do conflict resolution consultants and processors work with fault identifying?
I don't think they call it that, but you're trying to define areas of disagreement and find what kind of agreement you have and reach the best solution because of it, not fault.
Mm-hmm.
But intervention with addicts sometimes does do that. Yeah. If there's an alcoholic in a workplace or a family, that everyone can get together by prearrangement, agree we're going to stand firm,
mm-hmm.
and say, here's how your drinking hurts me. And everyone will speak that. And it is fault.
That's fault.
Yeah. Intervention certainly is on the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what do you do for response?
I was just going to say, I just recently heard a social worker talking about doing victim-offender mediation, where they bring together somebody who's been a victim of a crime with the offender, and it happens probably at the prison, and using the conflict resolution kind of modality. And he was relaying a story about somebody whose daughter had been murdered, and this had been years later that they did this mediation. And it brought about that forgiveness that this woman needed to find for that person through this, and it was probably a fairly long process. And it sounded like she was able to let go of a lot of bitterness, and her psychiatrist had not seen her so contented from the time that, that had happened. And so that process, identifying, I think it took the offender admitting that fault or that guilt. And, so it sounded like a pretty interesting
problem. Matthew doesn't seem to be too optimistic here about this being very successful. And as much as we've only got one statement here about, you've gained a brother, sister, but then the whole, the rest of the passage is basically describing, what's going to happen to this person if they don't listen. Mm-hmm. And then there's an increasing kind of drama which builds. First they don't listen to you alone, then take two, if they don't listen to you, then, kick them out, mm-hmm. essentially. And then it goes on then at the end of verse 19 with the famous saying, I say to you, if two of you agree on earth about anything they ask, presumably this would be the group that's come to kick the person out, or the group that's come to confront the person. So then that group would agree that this person should be an outsider from that point on, I would think. So that, if you will, the community then is gathering together and saying, okay, that person's out now. And not only do we think so, but God thinks so too. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of like a metaphysical decision about somebody's status. But then what puzzles me is verse 21, which then seems to open it up again about forgiving 70 times 7.
Right. Yeah. It seems to me Peter somehow at that point thinks that he still has a responsibility, even though we might have thought at verse 17, let him be a tax collector and a Gentile, we could wash our hands of them. Peter still thinks he's not been relieved yet of some duty. How often does he have to do this? And so I think we need to find a different way to read this. And I'll suggest one. I got going on this text a few years ago when a student in a class at Valparaiso was reading this paragraph out of a Living Bible, which is a paraphrase, not a translation. And this paragraph, believe it or not, in some of the earlier editions of the Living Bible, begins in the normal way, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault and so forth. But at the end, where it concludes with, let that one be a Gentile and a tax collector, it goes on and adds the comment, and so you will be vindicated. So that the goal of the procedure in the way the Living Bible presented it is vindication of one party and conviction, successful conviction of the guilty party. And I thought, wait a minute. That's not anywhere near true to the spirit of the parable of the lost sheep. So I got it in my head to go a little more deeply into this story. And one of the things that I wanted to know was, what is supposed to be the content of the speech if you're supposed to go and point out the fault or tell the fault? I want to know, okay, what is the Greek there for fault? Only to discover that what's there is an intransitive verb in Greek. A verb, that means a verb that takes no object. It's an intensified version of the simple verb to speak. Elego happens to be the verb. It means to speak convincingly. So literally, what this says is, if someone sins against you, go and speak convincingly. It does not suggest the content. Now, it is true, and I looked up all sorts of classical sources and whatnot, and this verb is used in debate, to talk about debate, and it's used to talk about legal proceedings, in which both the prosecutor and the defense counsel will speak elego. They will be as convincing as they can be, and of course the prosecutor's job is to be as convincing as possible about fault. But the defense counsel also is to be as convincing as possible the other way. So somehow or another, our English translations of this have stuck us with a fault-telling ritual that isn't there in the original text. This is a procedure of being as convincing as possible in some way that is meant to restore the community. Now, maybe in certain situations, the fact that something wrong has happened does need to be, agreed upon. But I've never found that in my family, when something bad happens, it works to say, it was your fault. Some other kind of discourse that's convincing has to happen. Something that says, please, let's not let this break us apart. And you try that one-on-one, and if it doesn't work, you get a couple more together, and maybe it takes the whole congregation to say to the person, please, let's not lose you to us. We don't want you missing. Please don't leave. And if they won't hear that, you can't convince them, then you treat them like a tax collector and a Gentile. How do you treat a tax collector and a Gentile? All right. Normally speaking, that's what that language means. Tax collectors and Gentiles are collaborators with the empire and eaters of dead pig meat. I mean, that's what those Gentiles do, you know. They put dead pig meat right in their face, which the Torah says you never, ever do.
Sounds like Matthew, to me, has kind of some hangovers from Judaism, legalism, and that's coming through here, not unlike Paul does sometimes, whereas Jesus, you know, he went around with tax collectors, obviously.
Yeah, and that's the point that I would finally make. It depends on whose model you use for treating tax collectors and Gentiles. A kind of conventional one or Jesus model. If you use Jesus model for how you treat tax collectors and Gentiles, the way I like to put it is, you know, this person who's lost from us that won't come to the supper anymore, if they won't come in, then I guess we're going to be eating in a lot of strange restaurants for a while. You know, we're going to have to be out there eating where they eat so we can finally get through to them that, if okay, we're going to be together. I mean, if you won't come in, then we're coming to you. We won't let you get cut off from us. And that's why Peter says, God, how often? How often do we have to do that? Peter has not got the clue here that they get to shun people, because that's easy. Write them off. The heck with them. Don't worry about them anymore. So I think there's another way to read this, and it suggests that how the community handles wrongdoing that threatens to fracture the community is to become a community that's utterly restless with the spirit of reconciliation. We will not rest until folks are reconciled to us. Or at least we have no authorization to rest. Because 70 times 7, for infinity, we must go through this. But it does happen, doesn't it, that people are lost to us, lost to the community, lost to each other. Families break up, communities break up, churches break up, things break up.
But not because they've gone out of their way to use Jesus as well.
No.
Because of lack of it, probably.
Yeah, we fail.
I mean, how often is this ever really?
That's right, we fail at this.
Very literally.
Yeah. Somehow this story I always remember when I think about this particular thing was told to me by a little bit older person than myself, who said that he grew up in Milwaukee in a two-story, one of these apartments with two flats, downstairs and upstairs. And in the downstairs apartment where he lived with his mother and family, they were Missouri Synod. Upstairs lived his mother's sister and her family, his cousins and uncle. They were Wisconsin Synod. And in 1954, was it, when the Synodical Conference broke up and the Wisconsin Synod and the Missouri Synod parted company, those two sisters never spoke to each other again. They lived upstairs and downstairs from each other and never again spoke. And finally, his mother died without ever having spoken to her sister again. You know, that kind of stuff happens. You know, it happens in families, in churches. It happens. This, we fail at this reconciliation business. And so we die without having loosed, let loose of the sins. And so there is,
if that's a trait of Northern Europeans more than other cultures. I mean, I'm Scandinavian roots myself, so I'm not casting experience here, but I've had the experience of fishing, a commercial fishing boat with pure Scandinavian cruise and pure Mediterranean type cruise. And one of the stories that I tell often is the difference in the way this sort of interplay goes on, you know, the forgiveness thing, you know, the Scandinavians really are pretty good at holding grudges, in my experience. I mean,
yeah,
somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but whereas the Southern European, these were Slavonian or Yugoslav, could get mad as heck, you know, at the time, but forgiveness is complete, you know, within a few hours they forgot there was even a grudge, you know.
Look what's going on in
this lobby. Well, I know. yeah, okay. I rest. Well, at least on the interpersonal basis, maybe between ethnic groups, that's a little stronger. You know, I don't know. But just on interpersonal, I'm talking one-to-one, I found it quite different. But that's an interesting point you bring up there.
Well, part of the, you know, one thing about Serbia and Croatia and so on is that there are a lot of families that are married by now. And that's true in our world also, and that would be true in the early church, and that there would be Jews and Christians and so on coming in. So the fact that you can do it within your ethnic group isn't enough. You need to be able to reconcile across those boundaries. It seems to me in this kind of community.
My question was just whether there was a, you know, within an ethnic group, within families or people that have to live together on a close basis, if it's harder for something out of Northern European culture for people to forgive. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that was sort of my experience. That's what I'm trying to relay, and I'm wondering if that had something to do with Martin Luther or Northern European culture or what. You know, I don't know. I'm curious, though. I mean, I've really experienced that.
Maybe it's just you get too cold, you know. Well, I went to a...
I really don't know because I'm just trying to process all that, but I was brought up Catholic, and I was really surprised because I started hearing all these comments about Catholics being so rigid about their stance, and it was really interesting because I'm Hispanic, and in our community, it wasn't that way. I mean, we were very forgiving and we were very tolerant of other faiths, as long as we stayed within our own faith, but we were tolerant of others. Whereas when then I was exposed to Irish Catholics and European, Northern European Catholics, and that was a very different way of looking at things from the Latin American Hispanic Catholic tradition. I was surprised to see the intolerance among some of the Northern European or Irish Catholic. And it's interesting
to explore anyway. This is going to tie up with that in a minute, but I have a question here, and that is that this seems to presume that whoever is the one who's speaking convincingly is in the right, and the other person is in the wrong, and so one speaks convincingly to sort of win them over or to point out what's up. But in my own parish, which is a very pietistic parish, heavily influenced by kind of a Norwegian pietism, which says that you need to have a living experience of Jesus in order to, you know, to, if you will, for the folks in this parish anyway, to be saved. You know, there needs to be that living experience of Jesus. And then we have a pastor, and a lot of our community is really not of that mindset, and so we're being accused then of being heretics and of being impure and of watering down the Christian faith and so on and so forth. If you will, if they were to take this passage seriously, right, they would be coming to us because they think we're it. You know, they really think we're at fault. And we're of the opinion that, well, you know, that there needs to be diversity in this community. So we're wanting to allow them to have a more pietistic expression of faith. It's just that we don't want to share that. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't really fit with us. And so there's a real struggle here with how do we create a community then?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You're right. This particular thing as it's laid out puts the burden of doing something initially on the hurt party, the people who feel they have been diminished somehow by what's happened. Obviously, in a family, usually everybody feels they've got dumped on somehow. You know, and, but what you're talking about is a totally different dynamic, that one group doesn't feel necessarily dumped on, unless, of course, you feel that the loss of that contact is a diminishment.
So they're leaving our community they're shunning us as tax collectors and Gentiles, if you will, and they're leaving our community because they think we're heretics.
Yeah. So that's an interesting twist.
See, but that is a description of what's happened to North American Lutherans in some ways, too, with the Missouri Synod.
Yeah.
Leaving, if you will.
Yeah.
Leaving the talks of the merger and so on, because the rest of us are heretic.
I guess we have to invoke other parables and so forth on that group. I do want to get for at least a couple minutes to what I think is Matthew's resource for thinking about what finally happens to the unresolved stuff that we die without having adequately attended to. You know, when there is stuff we haven't let go of. We have not let go of whatever it was that kept these sisters from talking for the rest of their life, and then life is over and we don't get to undo that. What happens to that sin, that break? I would take us quickly to the Passion narrative. Would you turn, please, to Matthew 26?
Can I just ask a quick question before you go on? Are you implying then that resolution is always towards unity?
Always what?
Towards unity. Always towards a bond in the community or the relationship.
Well, Matthew's book isn't long enough and developed enough to explain exactly how he would have seen what the whole completed picture looks like. My own hunch is that what he was most worried about had to do with the whole community of the Jewish people and the Christian Jewish people getting cut off from each other and never having anything to do with each other again. And just losing each other as humans. To each other. But exactly what his picture of the ideal situation would have looked like, we can't much tell.
But isn't the main part of the restoration back to God rather than community?
Well, ultimately, I think, because I think Matthew understands that we never do get our act together sufficiently, and it's up to God finally to clean up the mess, and God has to have God's own way of having people reconciled finally. Which I think Matthew does, and that's what I want to rehearse for just a moment here. In his Passion narrative, Matthew does also weave forgiveness of sins in such a way that the other Gospels, in a way the other Gospels don't. For example, only in Matthew, when Jesus passes the bread and cup at the Last Supper, in the cup word, Jesus says, "This cup is for the forgiveness of sins." Now that's where we get that in the liturgy. It's from Matthew and from nowhere else. And so the blood of Jesus in that cup works forgiveness of sins. Then, would you look please at chapter 27, verses 15 and following. We're going to have to march fast and take no prisoners here for a moment, or the tape will run out on us. But if you would look very briefly at this scene before Pilate, they had at that time this custom, evidently, to release a prisoner at festival time. So at verse 16 we read, "And at that time they had a notorious prisoner called," the new RSV says, "Jesus Barabbas." Some of you will have that in footnotes in your Bible. Because in Matthew, the oldest, best manuscripts actually identify this fellow as Jesus Barabbas, and text critics believe that it's much more likely that some scribes eliminated it from the original because of reasons of piety about the name Jesus, rather than, you know, there doesn't seem to be a motive for anyone to have added the name Jesus to this fellow's name. So probably this fellow in Matthew, and only in Matthew, was identified as Jesus Barabbas, which is a really weird name because Bar Abbas means son of the father. Abba, Bar, Simon Bar Jonah, and Abba his father. The Pilate's got a weird question here to ask in verse 17. Who do you want me to release, Jesus son of the father or Jesus called Messiah?
Whoa.
To Christian ears, that's confusing. And so the priests conspire for the request to have the Jesus Barabbas released, and Jesus called Messiah is slaughtered, and his blood is shed. And at the end, Pilate says, this blood's got nothing to do with him, but the people say, his blood be on us and on our children. If you're Jewish, reading this, as Matthew's first audience was, you've seen this before. Every year you have seen the priests take two identical male creatures, goats, though they picked, and they name the sins of the community over one and send it away, never to be heard from again. And the other they slaughter, Leviticus 16 says, and splatter his blood around for the atone for the uncleanness and the sins of the people. And the people say, his blood be on us and on our children. And Jesus said, his blood works forgiveness. And from the very beginning, Matthew had said, his name will be Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. So in Matthew's gospel, Jesus' death is portrayed as an atonement ritual, which works forgiveness for the people. So a tragedy has happened that they can't undo. Judas is dead. Jesus will be dead. What are we going to do about that? We have busted the thing apart. The blood of the atonement, however, cleanses the people of their sins. So there's two kinds of forgiveness in Matthew. There's the forgiveness that we're charged with trying to work out ourselves, and there is this other thing that God does that cleanses us despite our inability to get that reconciliation worked, and despite the fact that we kill each other and betray each other and all the other things that people do. So I read that statement, his blood be on us and on our children, not as an everlasting curse upon the Jewish people, but it's part of the atonement ritual, which Matthew understood to have forgiven everybody involved. Because everybody failed here. So that's how Matthew, I think, handles hatred. We are charged with being restless reconcilers. But God has God's ways of cleaning us up and having us back by means of Christ. We have 2 minutes for questions, comments.
I understand the point that Christ's blood was shed and in allusion to the goat that or the lamb that was sacrificed. Now, what did you say about the scapegoat? How did you relate that to the goat that was, the sins were put on and sent away?
Well, I think in this analogous ritual, Barabbas plays the role of the goat that gets sent away, because you never hear from Barabbas again, and he is named as a criminal.
Okay.
And that's what happened in the atonement ritual. They named the crimes of the people over that goat and then sent them away. The other goat over which you don't name any sins. You don't accuse that goat of anything, like Jesus is not accused of anything. And that goat gets slaughtered, and that goat's blood then is for the uncleanness of the people and cleanses from the uncleanness. Other Gospels do something similar to this. There's a soteriology, you know, an image of how the death functions as a saving event. And this happens to be Matthew's way of understanding how the death worked. It worked like the atonement ritual to forgive the sins of the world.
Why do they think that the blood of the goat originally had anything to do with forgiving their sins?
Oh, that would be a very complicated thing to track down. It had to do with the fact that according to the belief of the ancients, including the Israelites, the life of a creature was in the blood. In Leviticus also, where the laws about what you can eat and not eat are given, it says all the parts of the animal you can eat, but the blood you may not eat, because the life of the creature is in its blood, and that belongs to God. And so that you return by bringing it to the altar or pouring it into the earth, and you can eat the rest. So it's something to do with the sanctity of the blood as God's own possession was behind some of all that ritual, but it's much more complicated than that. And I can't really say exactly what all accounts for understanding blood to be an agent of forgiveness.
Yeah, but I guess my question is, how does the blood of an animal or slaughtering an animal have, that's what I understand, have anything to do with letting you off the hook? I mean, yeah.
It's just got to do with all those complicated ancient ritual beliefs about the nature of sacrifice, slaughtering a living thing. Something else must die so that I can live.
And this happens in many, many cultures.
Oh, yeah.
Sacrifice happens in many cultures, all independently of one another, as a kind of primordial way of finding reconciliation with divine power. There are still...
Yeah, I know that. I guess I just don't understand it logically.
It isn't logical. It's ritual, not logical.
I don't understand it in a way that... I mean, then what?
And why does God want that? That's Karen's question, I think.
I guess I've always felt like, I'm always thinking like, well, as a parent, if your kid does something bad, to get that child in the right relationship with you again, I mean, you wouldn't think of saying, okay, go kill your cat, you know, and then it'll be okay. I mean, you just, I don't think like that. So I have really a hard time, I always have, understanding this blood and sacrifice stuff, because I think of God kind of as a loving parent, you know?
Mm-hmm. But at the time the sacrificial system was set up, you have to go back in time to primitive people that this was understood and that this did mean a lot to them. It's a cultural thing.
Right.
This was the sacrifice to do away with all sacrifices, too. This was to end the system and say the system is rotten.